Hello, my fellow ocean lovers. I am Ellen Spooner, a marine biologist and science storyteller, and this is the Ocean Optimism Podcast, a show where we hear the untold and not often shared stories of ocean conservation successes and solutions. Time and again, we see the greatest challenges lead to the greatest opportunities. So dive in with me as I interview scientists, activists, and leaders to explore the incredible feats already underway to take care of our ocean. Hello, all of my fellow ocean lovers. I am so excited because today we get to talk to Dr. Heather Coldway, who is a marine biologist with the Zoological Society of London, National Geographic Explorer, and co-founder of Project Seahorse. She recently attended the United Nations Ocean Conference in Lisbon, Portugal, and we're going to talk about her experience there. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. This is really exciting to be talking about ocean optimism.
Yeah. And so before I jumped into asking you how the ocean conference went, I wanted to learn a little bit more for our audience about your background. What sparked your interest in marine conservation and why you started the ocean optimism movement?
I grew up really loving animals. And I think the career options at that point in time were, if you like animals and you're into, science, then you probably want to be a vet. And that's the thing. You're either going to be a vet or a teacher. And I don't think that marine biology was, really there as a career option. And I certainly didn't know the job I do today existed. So it was sort of navigating that route. Then I had to think differently because I had a great time at college, but I didn't quite get the grades I needed to be a vet. This is my non-strategic career direction, I guess. But then had the opportunity to go to university to study biological sciences and specialised in marine and fish biology, actually at the University of Plymouth, and learned to dive. And then the sort of, it opens out as being an option. And really, I think, started the academic route, but then quickly realized that perhaps the sort of hardcore science tenure track professor type position wasn't for me, but was really interested in how science can help save the world and save the ocean in particular. And so got me on a more applied route of how to use science. I think that really embedded my approach, which is around solutions. I've always found the challenges facing the world quite overwhelming and quite depressing, and have always just been thinking, okay, what can I do? What steps can I take? How do I surround myself with amazing people who can help, who've got the same mindset, who really want to make a difference? And that's from sort of all walks of life, from your friends to your family, from your work colleagues, from collaborators that you find along the way. And what's really encouraging is obviously everywhere you go in the world and every corner of your life, from your community to your friends, there's amazing people doing incredible things and really making a difference. So while that overwhelming picture can feel really depressing, each one of those people that you meet on your path can fill you with optimism. So that's really where my interest in sort of thinking optimistically was there. It's like, I need to have hope. I need to feel that I can make a difference. I need to see a pathway to do that. And so linking up with people like Nancy Knowlton, Ellen Kelsey, and others who were thinking the same way, and recognizing that not to be naive about the situation in the world, but actually to focus on solutions and amplifying solutions was important. And that's where the ocean optimism movement came from.
Yeah, I really like when you were talking about your community and all of the people that you meet along the way, giving you a sense of hope because they're doing incredible things, because I've definitely found that in my experience as well. Like you said, the issues that we're facing in the world can be so overwhelming, like climate change, but
a lot of my friends that I've met are doing really incredible things, even just like on a small local scale, like helping to here in San Diego clean up the Tijuana River watershed. And I am in awe of these people. And I'm like, okay, like, we're not alone in this. We're together fighting this. And so, yeah, I'm really thankful to have learned about the Ocean Optimism movement and help share some of those stories.
Yeah, and I think what you say is true everywhere. And having worked internationally in my career, it's not just, you know, in my backyard in the southwest of the UK or your backyard in San Diego. Literally everywhere you go on the planet, there's extraordinary people from all walks of life who are really making a difference. And there's some motivation there that may be around wanting, you know, a better planet for their children. It may be about, you know, sort of an experience people have had, but it's a very uniting thing. And so I think that thinking around ocean optimism was trying to find a way to be able to tell those stories, which is wonderful to be doing today. But, you know, there are many, many, many stories out there, and they come from surprising places. They come from typical places. And I think that's the other important thing, is that you tend to think that some of these solutions are going to sit with people who have traditional academic careers. But what I'm interested in is how actually everybody starts to see themselves as a conservationist and with a role to play. And, you know, it's not just the realm of, you know, people who have trained in that or are in the science community, but it's, we're seeing more and more that conservation is for lawyers, for people in marketing, for communicators, from teachers, from, you know, to the more traditional biologists and zoologists and all the rest of it. So I want everybody to start thinking that they are a conservationist.
I was having that exact conversation with my mom, who's a nurse, the other day, and talking about ways that nurses can help be conservationists with the ocean. And how you mentioned this is a global, international movement where you meet incredible people everywhere. I'm sure you met a lot of those people when you went to the United Nations Ocean Conference. And so I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the types of people that you met there and what issues were being discussed.
Yeah, it was remarkable being in Lisbon, and we were sort of on the water, which was very grounding in terms of what we're talking about. But obviously, this was a conference that had been delayed by 2 years because of the COVID pandemic. And to see 10,000 people in one place in three dimensions, not on a screen, was really quite incredible. And that really captured the energy and the interdisciplinary approach that we have for the ocean. So all of those examples that I was talking about, you know, people who work on ocean communication, work on campaigning, came from indigenous groups, from fishing communities and fisher leaders, and from all over the world. I think the big positioning was the, you know, we talk about small island developing states, and they were very represented there, but actually not thinking of them as small islands, but big ocean states. And so they're disproportionately impacted by decisions made about the ocean, the obviously highly dependent on the ocean, and also very vulnerable to some of the impacts that we're seeing around particularly climate change and the journeys that everyone has been on in those these last couple of years with the many challenges people have faced because of the impacts of the pandemic and other issues.
Yeah. Were there any individuals from these big ocean states that you met that really stood out to you with their story of how they survived the past 2 years and how they're maybe working to address some of the problems that they're facing?
Absolutely. I think there's some very powerful leaders from places like Palau and Fiji that stand out as really taking a leadership role in representing the ocean and many other small island developing states as well. So we're seeing things like the Seychelles taking leadership with how to sustainably finance ocean initiatives, They're the first nation that's had a financing structure that enables ocean conservation, empowers ocean communities, and supports ocean conservation. And that's a sort of debt for nature swap. So we're seeing these really interesting finance mechanisms that are certainly very familiar to a fish biologist like myself, but they start delivering some of the solutions we need to be able to set up entire nations on that sustainable ocean trajectory. And so having banks and investors and impact investors and insurance companies, certainly not the usual suspects for an ocean conference, but seeing that there is a good way forward in having this kind of sustainable financing structure to support the ocean, which does so much to protect people, provide livelihoods, reduced risk through, you know, keeping mangrove forests intact, stops erosion, it stops, you know, protects communities and livelihoods from storm surges and typhoons. So it makes good financial sense to invest in the ocean and support these communities. So for me, that's been a big shift over the last few years. And that was very evident with some major new investments announced at the UN Ocean Conference.
Wow, that's so incredible to hear that, like you were saying, the people with maybe not a typically ocean conservation-minded background getting involved and supporting these efforts, and like the specific example you gave in the Seychelles. And that leads me to my next question of what were some of the solutions and agreements that were discussed at the UN Ocean Conference?
I think some of the exciting movements are perhaps building on things we know. So, you know, marine protected areas and marine protection is something that we know works. We just need more and bigger. So while sort of international targets have been looking at sort of 10% ocean protection, there's been a high ambition group that have been looking at trying to get to 30% ocean protection by 2030. So the 30 by 30 movement, mm-hmm. and that really saw great strides in Lisbon. So we actually have reached a milestone of 100 countries committing to protect 30% of their ocean by 2030 at the conference, and a few more coming through just in the days and weeks following, which is incredible to have that commitment and that actual action. So seeing places that are already at working towards achieving that. So and countries starting to work together to look at how that they can expand their ocean protection. So around Ecuador and neighboring states and countries, we're seeing this real expansion and commitment to ocean protection. So that was one big win. And then I think in terms of sort of mitigating some of the ocean threats, everyone's quite worried about deep sea mining, which is exploratory at the moment, but obviously under some pressure to look at securing minerals like we use in our mobile phones, but with potentially devastating impacts to our deep sea ocean, which is, you know, our deep sea, which is poorly understood. But actually, President Macron of France stood up and committed to looking at developing a legal framework to stop deep sea mining happening and to have a moratorium. So I think some of these emerging threats, seeing that there is leadership and ambition of stopping those moving ahead, particularly in these extremely vulnerable parts of our ocean, which we are increasingly learning about how much they do in terms of trapping carbon and all of these other good functions. We're just learning about finding new species, obviously, every time somebody looks. So to start really mining that is very worrying. So to hear commitments to address that is exciting.
That is so refreshing to hear because, yeah, these are, as you said, like incredible areas that we still don't know much about. We still have so much exploration to do. And I was just reading an article from the World Economic Forum about the need to recycle the existing electronic material that we have so that we can use that instead of having to extract more. And I was wondering, if you heard in these countries who have committed to 30 by 30, I got the chills when you said 100 countries have committed. I'm like, that's what gives me optimism is hearing these sorts of things. Yeah. But how do these countries address some of the challenges and complications of actually protecting 30% of their ocean? Because so many people are reliant on maybe fishing or other things. And how do they work with their stakeholders and partners to protect these areas?
That's a great question. And I think that we are seeing a really big shift towards the sort of co-design and co-development of protected areas that are led by and managed by communities. So perhaps historically, marine protected areas were imposed or government mandated or kind of lines on a map without necessarily being effective. We know that marine protected areas work almost like a bank. They're an area where you invest, you protect, they act as nursery grounds. The fish and other species inside grow bigger, produce more. So the fish inside swim out and where they can be fished. So they work in terms of protecting and restoring biodiversity, but they also offer opportunities for income and livelihoods for local communities. So the engagement of local communities in what are called locally managed marine areas or community managed protected areas or whatever you want to call them is what we're really seeing is this co-development of these protection, which is far more sustainable. The other area is innovative approaches to be able to fund and support these protected areas. You know, there is a required investment to manage the protection, to look after them. And we're seeing some really innovative ways of doing that. So one initiative that I've been involved with in the Philippines, but is called Coast4Sea, that's linking seaweed farming to bigger and better marine protected areas. Mm-hmm. And the income generated by the enterprise of seaweed farming actually is helping the local communities, the local fishers, to have the resources to be able to invest in marine protection. So they sort of go in hand in hand of that business and protection. So I think it's very much shifting the dialogue that protection isn't a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And marine protection and conservation shouldn't be seen as giving something up or sacrificing. It's an investment for the future. And the only way that we're going to be able to feed families and secure protein and all of the wonderful things that the ocean does for people who are dependent on it around the world is by that investment to sort of have a sustainable future. And we know that marine protected areas are a part of that solution.
Wow, that's really cool and incredible story of the work that you heard about in the Philippines. I'm curious so you said they're farming seaweed. Are they selling it to be like additives in food products, or what sort of products are they selling the seaweed as?
Yeah, so seaweed is one of these amazing products that we're hearing about more and more, but I think is perhaps we might not have appreciated how much it's been part of our lives for so long. So carrageenan is a product that comes from seaweed, comes from seaweed farming. And that is in everything from toothpaste to ice cream and even in fire retardant. So carrageenan is a sort of ubiquitous product in many areas. The seaweed often has been started off produced by farmers in places like Indonesia, Tanzania, Philippines, with quite a dysfunctional supply chain to get to, say, an ice cream product. And so what Coast4Sea has been doing has been to look at how to, you know, in the sort of fair trade principles that we think about with things like chocolate and coffee, is to introduce those into the seaweed farming supply chain to make sure the practices are sustainable, to reduce the amount of plastic in the process, to make the benefits sit with the farmers themselves, and to connect the farming to marine protection. So we're starting to see these innovations happening that are win-wins for the environment, for the local communities. And obviously for us, when we eat our ice cream, it's nice to know that the products within that are coming in the same way that we do proactively look at in consumer choice, you know, about buying, whether it's organic or fair trade or whatever. But I think there's obviously, that is something we can do as consumers, is understand where products come from and make sure that they're ocean friendly.
I love that. I love that the idea that eating ice cream from a sustainable source can help be protecting marine protected areas. That's so awesome.
Exactly. Always feel good about eating ice cream.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so after attending this conference and hearing all these amazing commitments and stories, what makes you optimistic about the future of our ocean?
I think it often comes down to people. So an event that I ran and was involved in running was all about how we build that next generation of ocean leaders, with a particular focus on those coming from the global south. I think one of the reflections on the conference is it perhaps is dominated by people from Europe and North America still, and we need to work harder to think more inclusively and more with more diversity, and recognizing that as one of my amazing presenters, Asha DeVos from Sri Lanka, said that, you know, 70% of the world's coastlines are in developing nations, and therefore we need to be reflecting that when we look at who's, you know, making decisions and participating in these conferences. But seeing the number of early career ocean professionals who were there from all over the world, and their voices, their passion, their commitment, recognizing they are actually already ocean leaders. It's not just leaders of the future, but that we do need to work hard to provide opportunities, which includes funding, mentorship, access to sort of networks that you get from conferences like that. And so there is work to be done in that area, but it's certainly not because of a lack of amazing people. And this also came out at our event, and again from Asha, who said, you know, talent is equally distributed, but opportunity is not. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that we need to be very aware of and conscious of and actively addressing as we move forward.
Yeah, I think that is such an important message of increasing diverse voices and providing access for people, diverse people who are impacted in equal ways to share their solutions and opportunities with the world. And you mentioned people from the global south. Just for our listeners, can you define a little bit more what that means?
I guess it's what's been called developing countries as well. So, I mean, it's really defined by income to those countries. So I guess poorer nations that we'd be thinking of here, but poorer defined, I guess, in terms of economics. And that's, a sort of term. So the Europe and North America would fit into the global north, and then the more developing countries fit into the global south. And so it's making sure, as you mentioned, that those voices are represented, included. And there were some really nice examples given of there was an amazing woman who was a fish farmer from Kenya. And she was saying, you know, a lot of researchers kind of come and go, and the communities never really find out what happens or what decisions are made. So she was advocating what she called under the tree meetings, which was basically how women in her community meet, is they sit under the tree and share stories. And that doesn't just apply to the communities, but scientists need to be more thoughtful about how they're sharing and feedbacking, providing feedback on the work that they do. And I love the idea of embracing the concept of under the tree meetings to make sure you're communicating the right information to the right people in the right way.
Yeah, I love that. That is really powerful under the tree meetings. I think it's very important that, you know, as scientists give back to the communities that we're learning from and studying about. So that definitely gives me some optimism to hear that women like that have platforms at conferences like this. So what can like an everyday person do to help address some of these challenges, raise some of these voices, help take care of our ocean?
Well, I think we know the ocean affects everybody in the world, whether we're talking about weather, you know, even if you're not even in an ocean state or have a coastline, that, you know, the ocean is part of the air that, you know, the oxygen that you breathe and the weather that you experience every day. I think it is to take that in recognition that there is something that everybody can do. So that, you know, we obviously can talk about behaviors. So consumer behavior, plastics is probably the most visible and straightforward of those, switching to a refillable bottle, not using straws, not using plastic bags. Those are switches that you can do in everyday life. But we obviously need to make the ocean part of the conversation. And that is underlining how important it is as part of, you know, policy and the voters. So if politicians don't see the ocean being relevant or being something that people care about, then they're not going to do anything about it. So I think, you know, whether that's conversations or writing to your political leaders, or looking at that at a local level, that can be really important. And I guess reflecting on what can you do, everybody in different parts of the world are going to have different opportunities and abilities, but everybody can be a conservationist. Everybody needs to be a conservationist. And so I think focusing on solutions and the considerable resources that are online that can help you on that journey, whether you want to think about your climate footprint or what you can do for the ocean, or obviously reading, learning, and getting outside is really important. We talk about health and well-being, and you mentioned about, you know, the view of a nurse. Well, the healthiest thing you can do is for your well-being is to enjoy nature. And that's something that we have such busy lives we can whiz through, but actually spending time in the environment and taking a moment to appreciate it can be a very good starting point.
I love that. It's so amazing how it's kind of like a reciprocal relationship that we have, because we're working to take care of the ocean, but the ocean's also helping to take care of us by, you know, like you said, spending time in nature, calming, relaxing, anywhere you go, even in the forest, can help us find our mental health. I think especially during the pandemic, that was important for a lot of people to find that.
Exactly. I think also don't be intimidated by being perfect. It's just making a step in the right direction is the important thing. It's very difficult in busy lives, I know, with children and whizzing around, to always do the right thing all the time. But as long as you're thinking about it, aware of it, or learning and trying to generally move in the right direction, that's important.
Yeah, I like that. Learning, staying informed, taking personal action, and learning about politicians and policies that are supporting the taking care of our environment. I think those are all really great ways people can get involved.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, one thing going back to the UN Ocean Conference was the, you know, the Global Plastic Treaty is now on the table. You know, the political leaders are working towards how we look at addressing the challenges of plastic pollution in a legally binding agreement. And that has really come from public pressure. People have, you know, been really challenged by the images of, you know, the straw in a turtle's nose, or some of the horrific images, and see it in their own place, whether you're inland or coastal, urban or rural. Everybody has experienced plastic pollution to a greater or lesser extent. So that attention to that issue, the public pressure, has led to countries around the world committing to change. And that shows the power of what we can do, and starting with just one person.
That, I love that, because that's like my number one thing that I want to share with Ocean Optimism Stories, is that when you do take action, it does make a difference. And so this global plastic treaty and the potential of it to be legally binding is an incredible example of that, for sure. So with that, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the Ocean Optimism Podcast. I really appreciated our conversation, and I know I feel even more optimistic about this conversation, and I'm excited to get even more involved.
Wonderful. It was lovely to talk to you too, and to share some optimistic moments as well. And I think that's the, you need the energy from people all around the world, knowing that there's like-minded spirits who are everybody doing their bit. And that's the other thing, is just on social media, through listening to podcasts, and you know, there is a community out there of people that, you know, you feel you can connect with. And that's really, really heartwarming and important, because it is a difficult journey, but if we keep it positive, it does help.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Heather Coldway for coming on the Ocean Optimism Podcast. Be sure to tune in to the next Ocean Optimism episode, which will be released on Monday, August 22nd, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.